910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News for an aid bill. I'm Daria Albinger. It appears that a $95 billion national security supplemental funding package is headed for passage in the Senate. It includes additional and some say much needed aid to Ukraine as it continues to battle Russia. But many Republicans, like North Carolina Senator Ted Budd, don't like it. In before the vote debate, he said border security policy changes must take priority.
I will oppose this foreign aid package because we must put America first.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the bill is a message to the world.
Tonight we tell our allies, we stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world, the United States will do everything to safeguard democracy and our way of life.
The White House says President Biden will sign the bill promptly. This is ABC News. One of the largest audio streaming services in the world is reporting record profits.
The place where Taylor Swift's new album is setting streaming records, Spotify, is setting revenue records. In its latest earnings report, the company says in the first quarter of 2024, it passed $1 billion in gross profit for the first time ever. Total active monthly users, free and paid, were up 19% year over year to 615 million worldwide, and paid subscribers were up 14%. This comes after big-time cost-cutting and layoffs last year. Spotify let go around 17% of its staff, about 1,500 jobs. Jason Athenson, ABC News, Hollywood.
It's cicada time again, and those that are emerging in South Carolina are so loud that some residents are calling the police to complain. The Newberry County Sheriff's Department is telling residents on Facebook the noise is coming from long-dormant cicadas, not police vehicles. They say it may be annoying, but it is the sound of nature. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
It's a polka party, and for good reason. 30 years ago, legislation making the polka our state dance became official in Pulaski.
I think everybody in Pulaski showed up in Zielinski Hall or on the streets because it was a polka day celebration.
That's then-Governor Tommy Thompson who signed the legislation in April 1994. But do you know who got the barrel rolling on the idea in the first place? The Wisconsin Polka Boosters, a class of second graders, or the State Folk Museum? The answer coming up.
It's tradition, it's culture, it's food, it's beer, you know, heritage.
Heritage back to the 1840s when the polka became popular with Europeans and came to America with them. So who started the Make Polka Our State Dance movement? A class of Madison second graders, but the Boosters and Folk Museum supported those efforts. It's a cultural slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Lots to talk about. Came across an article from Monday. Grabbed my attention. Wall Street Journal headline screamed, Supreme Court signals sympathy for cities plagued by homeless camps. Yeah, those dirty hippies are sleeping in the parks. Gotta stop that. They said that the Supreme Court seemed ready to allow cities to crack down on these homeless encampments. Because the conservative justices questioned the lower court's finding that having these restrictions were unconstitutional and amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. And look, you know, this is the thing that gets me. When conservatives talk about how much they love, you know, and how much they care about, you know, fill in the blanks, it never really seems to come to fruition. It's a lot of rhetoric, a lot of talk. Very little action. You know, they talk about that guy they like so much. And, you know, the homeless, shouldn't we be helping them? The hungry, shouldn't we be helping them? The sick? There's somewhere in a book that talks about a guy who talked about, you know, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving shelter to the homeless, visiting those in prison. There was a guy. They talk about him a lot. They just don't seem to follow very much. So it got me thinking about, you know, if 2024 goes the wrong way and we end up with a Donald Trump in the White House and a conservative majority in the House and Senate, what would Project 2025 bring us? What kind of a future would our children have in conservative world? Because we know that they want to roll back civil rights protections. They, you know, they want to make it like the 50s again. They want, they are in the process of rolling back reproductive rights. So we're going to put women back in the kitchen again. They're all in favor of going after the LGBTQ community, put them back in the closet again. You know, they want to deregulate and neuter government so that, you know, wealthy and big corporations can control everything again. They want to go after healthcare and say, well, you can maybe get it if, you know, you can afford it, because we're going to privatize, profitize, and, well, rip away any help that the poor and the needy. Again, there was that guy in that book talking about helping the poor and the needy and the downtrodden. And then massive immigration crackdowns. Just a hellscape of bad. More attacks on labor rights. Weakening labor rights and ensuring that you can never really fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and, you know, using our military, because they love using the military against, you know, our own people. So we could become that country where there are gun turrets on corners. There are military police walking up and down the streets, you know, keeping social order while they're simultaneously dividing us on social issues and on race and on gender and you name it, however they can slice and dice and pit us against each other and keep everyone polarized to the point that, well, we don't talk to each other. We're not allowed. And this, you know, this conservative world should scare us, because there are people who are working to get to these places. And I know people are going to go, well, Rick, you know, you're going a bit too far. I don't know. Because I've been saying this stuff for all of these years, because this isn't new. Nothing I have said new. Because they've been very honest about it for years. Listen to right-wing talk radio over the last 40 years. All of these things are on their list of grievances. You know, those minority groups, they got too many rights. We need to start snatching some away from them. You know, those women, yeah, they got choices. Too many. You can't make this stuff up. Too many rules and regulations. Job-killing regulation. Oh, and education. Education. Did I mention education? You know, ensure that we privatize, profitize, and, well, ideologize, if that's even a word. Indoctrinize. With public money, of course. All of our children, all while claiming everyone else is trying to indoctrinate our children. I love hearing religious people talk about the public schools indoctrinating children. It always makes me laugh. And look, I'm all in favor of you teaching religion to your children, teaching them to be good, decent human beings, following that guy in the book who talks about, you know, helping the hungry and, you know, feeding the hungry and helping the poor and you know, healing the sick and all of those things. Maybe if we learned a little more of that, never mind. It's not actually accurate. But it seems to me that we're coming to this place where the worst things are coming out. The worst of us are happening. I look at New Hampshire. New Hampshire, evidently, congratulations, New Hampshire. You've beaten Florida for the craziest anti-vax state, because evidently in New Hampshire, they could be the first state to ditch the polio and measles vaccine for children. What? I look at Texas. Texas, as we speak, in the process of, well, how do you put this in a nice kind of way where you go, they're not totally crazy, but they are evidently going to do away with property tax. Evidently, they want to do away with property tax. And why would they want to do away with the property tax? Why would the lieutenant governor order Texas Senate come up with a plan to eliminate property taxes. Why would they do that? Oh, that's right. So they could destroy public schools. You can put an end to it. Now, you know, I did get a kick out of, in a lot of states, the lottery money is supposed to go to funding schools. Not a lot of it does. But that lottery money was supposed to be above and beyond, a little bit extra, supposed to help out. Wasn't supposed to be all of it. Understand what conservatives are telling us. And they're honest about this. They don't care about society. And they've been honest about this for years. They only care about themselves. The hyper-individual. They don't care about their neighbors. They don't care about the guy across the street. They don't care about you. Certainly not. Or me. Absolutely not. It's all about them. And even, and look, I would even argue that their ideology is even bad for them. Because you get down this road where we don't have an educated populace. We don't have people who are vaccinated. Now you've got these diseases running wild again that were almost eradicated. You know, there are spatterings of polio coming back. I thought it was gone. But you let these people who did their own research, you know, they were there in the bathroom with the YouTube video going. We could end up in a very bad place. This is why elections have consequences. Anyone who in New Hampshire, look, if you're in New Hampshire, anyone who votes to say, no, I don't think we should vaccinate children from polio, you should probably go, you're not a serious politician. You should not be any, you shouldn't even be allowed to visit the Capitol, let alone be in charge of it. And this idea that we're going to end taxing, and property tax. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Now, what's that going to do short term? Short term, you're going to be able to fill the pockets of property owners. The wealthy are going to get a little bit wealthier. And look, you know, not every person who owns a home is the wealthy, but a little bit better off than the folks who don't have it. Oh, how do you then educate a populace? Well, you do it the old-fashioned way. People who can afford it, their kids get an education. Those who can't, well, we now have a fresh pool of cheap, exploitable labor, because that ultimately seems to be the baseline of conservatism. You know, when they talk about it, you know, individualism and all their ideas, it all boils down to cheap labor. We want to make a segment of the population so exploitable that they'll work in poverty conditions for desperation wages. That seems to be what it is. Unless I'm wrong, is there some part of the conservative movement that I'm missing? Because, you know, as I laid out, there is this push to do all the things that I just said. You know, deregulate, you know, put women back in the kitchen, gays back in the closet, minorities back in the fields, all of this stuff. It's all front and center. They're not even trying to hide it anymore. Before, it was all done in dog whistle and coded language and, you know, with good PR behind it. Now it's just, you know, we want what we want. So the question is, how do you push back against that? I would argue for a vision for the future. And I think Biden has a pretty good vision so far. I wish we were bolder. It means workers having to go, hey, we want to do that organizing thing. We want to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. We want to fight for part of the pie. Because if you're going to destroy the public sector, if you're going to destroy the commons, if you're going to destroy what we the people have built, you better have a darn good private safety net, which must include labor unions and workers' ability to form unions. And, oh, by the way, collect some of the profits that their labor creates. Because if we're going to totally deregulate, it's going to be more profit for the boss. Workers should get a part of that. I mean, if they're going to suffer with the cancers, I don't know, maybe having a little bit of money to go into the private healthcare system to be able to maybe live another day, that should be part of it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So lots of really positive responses from yesterday's show on the big win at Volkswagen in Tennessee. Thanks to our friend John Russell, reporter over at More Perfect Union, and Eric Loomis, our basic resident labor historian. They both spent a lot of time talking about really the historic nature of this victory and what it actually could mean. Could this be that spark that reignites organizing across the country and rebuilds that prosperity that the working class once enjoyed? I'm hoping, always hopeful. But if you missed any portion of that show, you can get the podcast, thericksmithshow.com, or freespeech.org, or you can check out the video. You know, as we've been saying for nearly, well, two decades now on this program, unions are about workers. Workers are the union, and here to talk about the historic victory at Volkswagen, I've asked Victor Vaughn to come talk with us. Victor is a worker at the Volkswagen plant there in Tennessee. Victor, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So let's get to this. This is a kind of a big freaking deal. Yes. Agree?
Definitely. This is a moment in history that people will remember for years to come. It's been awesome to be a part of this.
Did you have any sense that it was going to be an overwhelming victory? Look, when someone asked me, I said, I think they're going to win. I think it'll be close. I did not in any way, shape, or form expect 73% of the vote to go that way. Did you?
We expected it to be a little more than the 50 plus one that everybody, you know, thought we would get. We didn't realize it was going to be in the 70s. You know, we were hopeful that if we could get 55 plus, it would be a good statement, but we wanted to really show a good showing, you know, throughout the campaign. And by day two, reality started setting in for us. Yeah. We started the sea of red shirts with the Stand Up UAW logo and future member on the back. And we knew then that, hey, something's big is about to happen here.
You did send a statement. I'll be honest. It is a statement with a punctuation point at the end. Now, you were one of the volunteer organizing committee folks. So you were out there doing the pounding the pavement, talking to people, trying to convince folks, you know, to your side. What made you jump into that?
Well, early on, when I first got hired into Volkswagen, I had a slight injury like about day three or four of working. They called us industrial athletes, and we had to do a kind of a pre-regiment workout 1 hour before your shift for 3 weeks. Some people equated it to military boot camp training. I had a slip and fall on concrete while I was running steps, and we did hard impact. I had to deal with that injury on my own. I did not receive any medical attention from our on-site medical. And from there, I knew there were some issues that need to be addressed. Fast forward, you know, a few weeks later, other employees in that same class with me were having, you know, similar injuries, and not what I had, but some things were happening and people were just quitting because they said they didn't sign up to be an athlete. About a month into the work, I started hearing stories from the employees about how they were being treated by the management, the unsafe conditions and things of that nature. I received another slight injury that I'm actually still dealing with, but we knew that no one was listening to the concerns of the employees. You know, I saw firsthand how some of our employees were being mistreated, you know, just disrespected.
Yeah.
And that's not good for the workspace.
No, I say all the time, look, I've done organizing for years, and you know, it's always wages, hours, conditions. Sounds like conditions a big part of this.
Conditions is a very big part of the why. We found that out real quick after we discovered that, you know, hey, it was time possibly that The employees could look at getting the union back in here, and UAW would have an opportunity to help us pull off this campaign. We started finding out what the why was. Safety in the plant was one of the top. The next being good quality health care, low cost or no cost health care, and profit sharing. But it wasn't about the mighty dollar, the bottom dollar. That was not the thing that drove this campaign for employees. It was literally being recognized. There's lots of talent within our plant, and we wanted the management to know that your most valuable resource is walking around that plant. We're the ones that's building that car. You know, we want to be a part of the decisions. You know, we were put on mandatory Saturdays, but we couldn't find out until Thursday of every week by lunchtime if we had to actually be called for mandatory overtime on Saturday. So people were not being able to go to events with their families, things of that nature, and it was just too much to handle.
Yeah. No, it's about, you know, again, as I said, I've done organizing work and, conditions. Part of those conditions are, you know, how are you treated? Are you treated with dignity and respect? Is your family time valued? And it sounds like this was a driver in this campaign. And again, these are things that employers could control, and Volkswagen had ample opportunity to control, but chose not to. So let me ask you, you know, because we covered the 2014 campaign. The conditions sounded the same. Why do you think this was different? Why do you think it was different from 2014 or 2019? Why was this different?
I think this campaign was so much different. One, because we knew some of the things that had happened to those previous two campaigns. And we had a lot of those employees that either went to that first or second campaign let us know that, hey, we were promised, you know, things would change. We haven't seen it. We need your help. We need your energy. And we want you to understand that it's not going to change again if we don't band together and do something about it this time. Otherwise, we may not get another shot. And we heard that word from, you know, our veteran workers. And we knew that we had to get the campaign rolling, and we had to get everybody to understand exactly what was at stake. If you wanted a voice at the table to help make that positive change, and you had to step up to the plate, put some skin in the game.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're singing my tune. You know, I say all the time, you know, every CEO in this country has a contract. Every working person should as well, that lays out what's expected of them, what their conditions are, what their wages are, all of this stuff in a way where there's not favoritism, where there's not, we're going to change things one week to the next. This sounds like you guys are heading in that right direction. What was the reservation of folks that you talked to? 27% of the people voted against it. What was the rationale there, do you think?
We heard a lot of the rumors that the company would just pull up stakes and leave Tennessee and shut us down, or we would get, you know, backlash by, we would have to work more overtime if we didn't do this because they would be angry at us, or they would take away certain benefits like the lease car program, for instance, or they would send it overseas to one of the other plants. Like, we had to fight hard to get employees to understand what their basic rights were, and two, the financial strength of the company, and why would they want to pull up stakes from the only plant here in North America? And, you know, three, we control the ship. We are the ones making the cars. They're selling them. They've got orders for them. But if we're not there to make them, how are we going to sell them?
No, excellent point. And, you know, the thing is you look at Volkswagen, your plant, as I understood it, until you guys, you know, voted this way, the only plant in the world that doesn't have worker representation.
That is correct. And that was one of the other things that I think really helped us in this campaign, Rick, was to let them know that, hey, we're only asking for what our sister plants have.
Right.
The basic things, you know, respect, you know, profit sharing, a seat at the table, and one, just to feel like human beings in the workplace. Anybody should not have to go through some of the things that our employees have been going through, not just this past few year or two as we started the campaign, but prior to that.
Right.
So the way that, you know, we're reclaiming employees' rights.
Now, good for you. Good on you guys. Hey, look, a historic, amazing victory. Let me ask you, how much of this statement election, because look, 73%, a real statement. How much of it is because, you came out of the pandemic, we're told you were essential frontline heroes, you know all the rhetoric, and how much of it was that there is new fire at the UAW, new leadership, a direction that is talking about organizing? How much did those play into this victory, do you think?
Oh, that was huge for us. I honestly don't think we could have pulled this campaign off if we had not had Sean Fain and that new regime in place. And he let it be known what had to be done in order for us to do this. It was us. We, the employees, were the union. It wasn't UAW. You know, they told us the things that the UAW would do for us as far as our support arm, our legal arm, et cetera, et cetera. But it was us. They weren't the ones that was going to have to hit the pavement and talk to the employees, find out what their whys are, and put it on paper and then make it happen. And that was a big change. Employees that seen some of the things that have happened in the years prior to that, when he came down and spoke with us one-on-one and took his time to come and let us know his story, we knew then that, the right person was in that right position, and we were in the right position to make this moment in history.
In order to have workplace democracy, you have to have the workers in that place having a voice and a say. And look, good on you guys. So let me ask you this, because you alluded to a moment ago in the past campaigns that there were some promises made by the company, but also some pressure politically from people saying, hey, we might not give subsidies to these places anymore. There may be some political blowback. Did you hear much of that? And when the six governors signed that letter, did that impact in a positive or a negative way?
At first, when our governor came out and made the statement that he felt like the employees did not need to unionize, it really stung us. It hurt. One, because we have a plant here in Tennessee, GM, as you know, down Spring Hill, Tennessee. And when that plant came on board, the governor came out and made, a glowing statement and recommendation and talked about how it was going to uplift the community and how things would get so much better for Williamson County, which is the richest county here in the state. It worked, but we didn't get that type of, welcome or enthusiasm or boost that we could do the same thing for Chattanooga if we had that opportunity to unionize. Because, we told everybody from up front, it wasn't about the dollar. It was about the respect in the workplace, about the safety in the workplace, having a voice at the table so that we can create a better lifestyle for our families and ourselves.
Amen.
And thus, it would be cyclical for the community. We could give back more to the community, and we could literally be another Spring Hill, Tennessee, only better. And we did not get that type of support, and it really hurt a lot of employees.
You can be moving in that direction to make that reality now. So let me ask you kind of the last line of questioning I've got for you, because the sentiment has been, at least most of my lifetime, that you can't organize in the South. So workers in the South don't want unions, it's not important to them. This kind of pushes back. Do you see this as what I am hoping it is that spark that ignites across the South where we put down the divisions of the past and go, really, it is about conditions. It's about dignity. It's about respect. It's about family. Do you see the potential of that happening?
Yes. And it is already happening, Rick. Just take, for instance, the Mercedes plant that's going through what we're going through right now, Hyundai, and some of the other locations that are falling in line. We, the employees here in the South, are very intelligent workers. We've got lots of talent walking throughout those plants, talent that has good ideas that could hopefully help spur each of our companies to be more productive if we were only asked our opinion, if we only had an opportunity to say that. Our governor, I'll go back to this, it talked about, the Southern values. Well, our Southern values, one, is hospitality, treating people with respect, honoring your families, and uplifting your communities. Those are the type of things that, I grew up in my community, as well as some of these others. So, we're here to prove that, we're not that slow-minded, just happy to have a job type employee here in the South. No, we're productive, and we are family-oriented, and we are community-oriented. We're going to prove that.
Good on you, Victor. I wish you and your coworkers the absolute best. You got a message for the folks in Alabama at the Mercedes plant?
Yes, just keep on keeping on. You've got support right up the road here from you. Anything that we can do to help you overcome some of the obstacles that we came into that can make your process go faster, please reach out to us. We are here.
There you go, Victor Vaughn. I appreciate you taking time for us. Good on you. Celebrate, be happy, and fight for that contract.
Thank you, Rick. We appreciate your time.
Outstanding, Victor Vaughn. I think this could be something really big, but I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Tell me what you think. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt Nair on Air.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Some clouds around this evening and maybe a stray sprinkle, otherwise a clearing sky overnight and the wind settling down, but cold. Lows in the low 20s. Sunny forecast for tomorrow, highs return to the mid-50s. And even more sunshine Thursday, highs near 60. Right now it's 33.
Whether you own a local business or a global one, you're always looking for ways to position your operation to create opportunities and move on them faster. With Bank of America, you get access to experts, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter, locally and globally. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Copyright 2024 Bank of America N.A.
Your forecast for you and your community.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown tweeted out that Chinese electric vehicles are a national security threat. And look, this is something we've been saying for a while, not new, but he took it to a different place. You know, he said, imagine these cars driving our streets, sharing information about our country with China on a whole new scale. He said, we can't let China collect sensitive data about our roads and who's on them. We must ban Chinese EVs. And it got me thinking, you know, I hadn't even thought of this. But if you remember the balloons, how people freaked out about the fact that there were balloons flying around. Imagine on every street and in every driveway, a balloon. Imagine what that would be. I got to tell you, we're in a weird, weird moment. And, you know, as I was thinking earlier today, we're in a situation where never in history have I been able to find where two the largest economies, the largest militaries, the big players are so intertwined, interdependent, and so competitive. And, well, not in a good way, I don't think. And that's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
So let's start with the Sherrod Brown comment. I mean, you know, look, we've been talking about EVs being a national security threat for the manufacturing part of it. The fact that if we lose the auto industry, pretty much all of the rest of manufacturing goes with it. But he's taking it to this next level of, you know, be very afraid of that thing that's sitting in your driveway, tattling on you with everything that you want. And if you're afraid of those social scores, this is the start of it.
Yeah. Yeah, the Senator Brown has a point, Rick. I mean, this is a major concern. This is an ongoing concern about a variety of different access points for the Chinese government to U.S. data, to citizens of the U.S. data, or even to the data of, say, dissidents or critics of the Chinese regime who happen to be in the United States as well. And I want to tee this up first by saying that there are valid reasons to be concerned. We know that at every opportunity, the Chinese military hacks into databases to try to gain information about Americans, okay? And the, you know, Americans who are active in spaces, policy spaces that they care about. So that's number one. Number two, there is a precedent for the U.S. government being concerned about this. I mean, there was a dating app, well, it still exists, called Grindr, which was popular, was owned by a Chinese company, and the U.S. government forced the sale of it to a non-Chinese company so that it could stay operating in the United States because there were concerns about data collection and the sensitivities there. This is the same debate we hear about TikTok today, where it's a Chinese-owned company that has access to all of this data. And while it makes claims about, like, well, it's actually on an Oracle server in Texas or whatever, the truth of the matter is that there have been cases, well-documented cases, where even TikTok itself has accessed the data of some critics, media critics of it. As a Chinese company, it has to answer to the Chinese government if the Chinese government were ever to make such a request. And then just the final point to tee up this conversation is the other reason why we should be concerned about this is I am sure you've seen some of those videos about how to hack into a vehicle remotely, these connected vehicles, whether it's an internal combustion engine or or EV, because everything is wireless and everybody has, you know, it's a smart car. So it's sending data back to data back to the home base. And I'm only laughing about this because one of the things that my lovely wife refuses to do, and I'm okay with this, is get any smart appliance in our kitchen. She's like, I don't want anybody knowing what we're cooking or what's in our refrigerator or anything like that, or when we're home, when we're not home. So look, this is a legitimate set of concerns. And I'm glad that Senator Brown is raising this, not only through kind of the jobs, the economic prism, but also through the perils of connectivity and access to data, and particularly if it's available to an authoritarian regime that has an axe to grind with a number of Americans.
Maybe not even just an axe, just a competitive advantage. I mean, the reality is, you know, we're two very different cultures, two very different political systems, ideologies, however you want to frame that. And, you know, I was sitting thinking about this today before we talked, and I can't think throughout the history of humanity where you've had the two largest economies on the planet, the two largest militaries on the planet, the two largest exporters on the planet is intertwined and as dependent as we are. And look, you know, I think China's dependent on us as well as we are. And I think we saw that during the pandemic, just how, you know, how desperate and dependent we are on them. That's not a good place to be. At least I don't think so.
No. First of all, it is not a good place to be. Second, I completely agree with you. It is rare, if not unique, that you have powers that can shape the outcome for the world, who are the two largest economies in the world, who have such a deep, although one-sided, trade relationship. And I think that is, that's unique. And also that we're in an era where there's such sophistication of products that there's a ton of parts. That didn't used to be the case either, right? And so there's more to, you know, there's a bigger playing field, so to speak. And at first, you know, the theorists thought that this would be a good thing, that because of this interconnectedness, that the two countries would come closer together politically, the Chinese would be exposed to democratic norms and want to embrace that, and the government would respond to the will of the people. Well, that didn't happen. And now the Chinese government can weaponize its supply chains, and the US depended on them. And here's just one little aspect of this. If you're looking at the lithium ion battery supply chain right now, and these are going to be both the power storage and the power generation devices of the future, right? And I mean, they're here now, but they're going to be even more ubiquitous in so many of the categories, whether it's processing or some of the materials that go into it, like lithium or graphite, or any of that. It is, you know, in some cases, 90% of the world's capability is in China. So it's not just us, it's everybody else too. And that kind of concentration is very difficult. But it is not to say, and I guess here's the thing, that, you know, our companies are, you know, especially the large global multinational companies, you know, they want to keep things generally open with China, but they are certainly capable of finding alternate sources if they need to. Okay. And so it's not like they're helpless children. These are well-resourced companies that can figure out alternatives to China if there is more pressure to do that. And I honestly think that there should be, because I do think that that kind of dependence is not a good place for the United States of America to be from an economic or a national security point of view.
Now, you mentioned something a moment ago that got me thinking, you know, because I go back to the era where they were selling us on this idea that, you know, the Chinese are going to be like us. And I remember going, no, I don't think the communist government's going to allow that. They don't have the same freedoms, the same culture. It's just, it's not going to happen. And I remember arguing, you know, 20, 25 years ago that our arrogance is going to get us into trouble. Arrogance with a healthy helping of greed. I think that's why we're here. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I do think that is so true, that there was this such confidence in this idea that exposure and economic openness would beget more civil liberties and openness in China, in other areas. And the Communist Party has made sure that hasn't happened.
Right, but here's the thing. I agree with it on paper, Scott. I agree with it on paper. On paper, everything's perfect. Every when I coached football, every play I drew up scored a 100-yard touchdown. But on paper, this is one thing. In practice, the Chinese Communist government was never going to allow free markets. They were never going to allow people to have access to the things that we have here. In fact, they don't even allow their citizens to see the TikTok that they the video crack that they feed our children.
Yeah, or any of our social media apps, by the way. So not just including TikTok, but like Facebook and others too. Because, right, they don't want that. And there's a great firewall and you can't get any information that Westerners get about the world. Basically, it's all spoon fed by the Chinese government. But I do want to make a distinction here, because I really do think that it's important to keep up cultural and educational exchanges, and that there should be trade. It should be reciprocal, and it shouldn't ever put the United States in a bind. And so the idea of completely shutting us off from China, I'm not in favor of.
No, of course not.
And there might be some people who are. I'm definitely not in favor of that. But, you know, we also have to be realistic about what, you know, about what the economic relationship is and what the limitations are, and the need to find alternate sources, preferably here at home, but if not with our allies and others, so that we can unwind some of the vulnerability that we had. Because the connected car example is a perfect fit, because there are some people who want to make sure that Americans have access to Chinese EVs, whether they're built in Mexico or China, elsewhere in Asia, or even in someday in the United States, maybe. And it's just a very bad idea because of that subservient relationship that those companies have to play to the government, the authoritarian government in China. And we know that information and data has been weaponized in the past. So this isn't just like an academic exercise. Like, we know this is a credible threat.
Yeah. Now, look, I'm not an isolationist, and I've said this 1,000 times. I'm a protectionist. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. I didn't build a giant moat around my house to keep everybody away. You can come knock on the door and I can let you in, but you don't get to just walk in. And sadly, what we've allowed is we've allowed the Chinese communist government to just walk in, and not just walk in, but kind of take over. You look at a lot of the farmland that's being bought up, a lot of the companies that we've not lost. We know where they are. They're there. So, you know, we've been really dumb in some ways. And again, I go back to arrogance and greed getting us into this mess. So the question then becomes, you know, how do you decouple this? I mean, you know, President Biden is talking about tariffs. You got Trump who was talking about, I think, you know, I forget, triple the amount of tariffs or whatever it is. Is that the way forward? How do you see this decoupling, if you will, happening? Or just is it about holding China accountable to what we've already agreed to?
Yeah. Well, it's a really good question. And if there was an easy, you know, one size fits all answer, we would have done it by now. The fact is that it takes some level of sophistication, and it takes a multi-pronged approach. And certainly tariffs are one aspect of an approach that can disincentivize imports coming from China and scatter them elsewhere, hopefully to the United States, but if not, like our allies or our free trade partners as well. But at the same time, Rick, it's not like that investment is going to happen by itself in the United States just because of tariffs on Chinese products. Right. And that is what I think is it makes the Biden industrial strategy more credible, is that we're actually going to invest in those areas where we know this is going to, you know, this is, these are going to be the economic battlefields of the future, and we want to be making this stuff. And in many cases, we are way behind, you know, way behind, whether it's solar or EVs or what have you, batteries, and we have to play catch up. And the other thing that we need to do is to enlist our allies so that they understand what we're doing, and that they ought to be joining us rather than trying to play us and China off of each other. And so I think that's important as well. And finally, our citizens need to understand what's at stake. You know, there's a lot of people who utilize TikTok who probably don't give a second thought to what's happening to their data or the vulnerabilities, or just like, you know, if they were utilizers of Grindr or sitting in a car or anything that has connectivity. You have, you scroll through the terms and conditions and you clicked I agree, because they were like 50 or 60 pages, and you have no idea kind of what your exposure is. And so that's really important for people to understand how, and to take more personal responsibility for their own consumption and their own data privacy as well. That's got to be a part of this, part of the solution.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was one of the things that I wanted to talk about. I think the Biden industrial plan, while in its infancy, is a step in the right direction in reshoring manufacturing, because how I think you combat this, and you're right, there's no simple silver bullet solution, but you do it from a position of strength and the ability to produce your way out of this, not out of dependence where we've been. So this idea of doing things out of strength, having a commitment to doing that, and then I would argue, as you put, you know, a call to action of we the people going, hey, you know, I don't want to, you know, everyone walking in lockstep, but some concern of the jobs that are there, you know, might be yours, might be your neighbors. I don't know. We need to be thinking about this stuff again, because I look at, if Chinese EVs come flood this market, the auto industry is done, and with it, lots of manufacturing, and then sadly, your national security base has just gone away.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And we have a long way to go on that road. It is so easy right now to just, you know, if you have a smartphone, to open the App Store and to download TikTok or Shein or Temu, these Chinese companies, and to buy from them or to share, and not give a second thought of what the consequences are either for you or for our economy. And so that's why we need these policy solutions, but also to kind of socialize this idea that we have to take more responsibility for this, and we all have the tools to do that.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you. Now, we've been talking about this for a while. You and I have been talking for what, 15, 18 years now about this stuff. You know, think of just how fast the transformation of our economy, the transformation of the globe happened because of bad policy. When was PNTR, Permanent Normal Trade Relation, PNTR? When was that? It was like 1999, right?
Yeah, it was passed in 2000 and China joined the WTO in 2001.
We're less than 25 years into this, and look at how much has been done. We got a lot of work ahead of us. But Scott, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some thoughts. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Yeah, appreciate it, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on.
Anytime. Our good friend Scott Paul. Check out the work that they do over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. We will get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts. You concerned about the EVs in your driveway collecting data, or is that too conspiratorial? Is it something you would hear on the right? Sadly, I would agree with. It worries me. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1956. That was the day of the founding of the Canadian Labor Congress. Today, the Canadian Labor Congress is the largest labor organization in Canada, representing some 3.3 million workers. During the early 1950s, labor leaders in Canada were becoming increasingly uneasy about the rising influence of big business in the country. They knew that labor must stand united as a force representing the interests of workers for safe job sites and fair wages. In 1953, the country's two major labor organizations decided to form a unity committee. The Trades and Labor Congress of Canada had been focused on craft unionism, much like the AFL in the United States. The Canadian Congress of Labor emphasized industrial organizing, similar to that of the CIO in the U.S. The goal of the unity committee was to promote cooperation between these two Canadian labor groups and explore a possible merger. In 1955, labor leaders from the United States also recognized the importance of union solidarity to stand as a counterweight to the rise of big business in the U.S. The AFL and CIO merged. The next year, the Canadian merger was also complete. In Canada, the early Canadian Labor Congress had strong representation among manufacturing, transportation, and mining workers. Later, they organized more public sector workers, such as postal workers, nurses, police, and firefighters. By the late 1990s, the Canadian Labor Congress represented 2.5 million workers from 51 different unions. Each year on April 28th, the Canadian Labor Congress holds a National Day of Mourning. The day is set aside to remember all of the Canadian workers killed on the job. In the 1950s, labor solidarity was on the march on both sides of the Canadian border.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I've been getting a lot of email and traffic from people, you know, complaining about TikTok. And, you know, one of the things I think is really important to think about in this relationship that we have with China, with the Chinese Communist government, is it's really been one-sided for a very long time. The fact that you, as an American company, cannot own anything. You have to have a Chinese partner. And look at, if you're the Chinese, smart, did all of the right things, used all of our arrogance and all of our greed against us, you know, made the promise of, oh yeah, you're going to get access. Sure, you're going to be able to sell to our, you know, billion plus people. You're going to make lots of money here. Only to have American companies go in there and see a massive technology shift. And, you know, just the other day I was talking with my son about, you know, this massive transformation. It wasn't all corporate interest. Walmart played a huge part of this. And, you know, I remember I had, you know, former Senator Byron Dorgan on the program, who wrote a book, you know, I guess this is going back about 10 years, 15 years ago, where he said, look, you know, look at the Huffy bike. You know, Huffy bike used to be made in the U.S. It was a good, sturdy, solid bike that virtually every kid in the country had at some point. And because of Walmart and because of the pressures to lower the prices, we need to get that price down so we can have higher profits. They were basically forced to go to China. And there was a push, not just, you know, with only Walmart, but retailers in general, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, helped make a pipeline. It was a massive a massive move. And very quickly, look, 25 years in the grand scheme of things, not very long. When you think about just how fast we lost our manufacturing base, just how fast communities were devastated, and with nothing to help shore them up. And this is where my frustration is. You look at all these bad trade deals, they all had trade adjustment assistance in them because they knew, well, we're going to lose jobs, but rich people are going to get richer. And you go, but Rick, you know, this was a bad system. Yeah, for you and me. And it's like all of this stuff that working people have been sold my entire life. You know, if we just give rich people all the money, it'll you know, someday trickle down to us. And what we found is, no, their insatiable appetite for more, their greed knows no bounds. And we've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. Just as, you know, these trade deals, these were supposed to be about making, oh, this is going to make consumers' lives so much better. For about that long, what it was really about is making corporations an enormous amount of profit. And it did that. Problem is, the Chinese weren't willing to be everywhere else in allowing U.S. companies to come in and produce portions of a product. They wanted it all, and they wanted the technology because they eventually wanted to do what they have done, which is retro-engineer or just steal the technology outright and make their own stuff with their own names, their own workers, their own profit margins. This is where I keep coming back to our arrogance and our greed, something quite remarkable. And I find it interesting that people now are, you know, well, I got TikTok and TikTok. How can we ban TikTok? We should be. And it should have never been allowed. That's the weird thing. You know, when you have bilateral agreements, they're supposed to be leveling. We don't get to have the same access. So again, I come back to what I said earlier about, you know, everything on paper works perfectly because, well, you can predict what the other side is going to do. And on paper, everything works according to logic and according to the laws of economics and the rules of nature and, you know, good, decent American values, only to find that they don't share any of those. And it really is about what it's about, which is being the global dominant player in every arena. Because understand, they are the largest manufacturer in the world right now. We gave that up. We didn't lose it. We gave it up. Because the stuff that they're manufacturing, stuff that we created. They are now trying to catch up with military spending. They are now the, you know, one of the, I don't know, they haven't reached the top of the economic scale yet, but we're struggling. And when you look at the fact that, you know, we do have massive trade with each other, the number I saw in 2022 was, you know, trade between the two countries exporting $750 billion. And the sad reality of we were the loser on most of it. Massive trade deficits. And you go, well, how can that be? Well, it can be because we don't make as much as we used to. And we need to start. And this is where I give Biden credit. Biden has had a vision on how we're going to reshore manufacturing, how we're going to be competitive. And as I said a moment ago, it's going to take strength, which means you need to invest in infrastructure. You need to invest in manufacturing. It takes commitment. You need a long-term strategy, a plan, kind of like the Chinese do in their 100-year plans. We need to be committed to this. And we also need to have a nation of citizens going, yeah, we probably should. If for no other reason, national security, maybe we should be a producer nation. Maybe we should make stuff again. You think? And this, again, is where I come back to this moment of I'm not an isolationist. I am a protectionist. There is a massive difference. And I'll wear that protectionist label because everyone agrees. I don't know anybody who leaves their door, their front door of their house wide open for anyone to walk in and take whatever they want. Everyone closes the door and most people lock it. Now, I don't know any people who have moats around their house, but I'll tell you, if it meant losing your stuff, you might. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Freespeech.org for the video. Thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.